My apologies to the university. We're starting late, and some of you may have been here the last time we were scheduled, and we had an important issue on the floor that didn't end. But we have three people here today from the Metropolitan Council, from Ramsey County and Hennepin County, because there's one bit of information I need before we can shape the bill relative to Central Corridor. If there are people here assuming a presentation on Central, that's not our intention today. So if you're here to hear the full explanation of the project and to testify, there will be another opportunity for that. Today, I just want advice from these three gentlemen about what is the right number, and because it's a significant issue, we wanted it public. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Shetman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come here and with the commissioner. And first of all, I want to say that yesterday was a very historic day for the Central Corridor, and with the help of these two gentlemen and many other folks, including the University of Minnesota, the City of St. Paul, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, and others, the council was able to adopt the project scope for the Central Corridor. And the reason why I am here today with commissioners is we have arrived at a bonding number that we need and are looking forward to the legislature and the governor proceeding with in the 2008 bonding bill. And that number is $70 million. $70 million works for a variety of reasons. However, the most important reason is that the $70 million that we would hopefully receive from the state will allow us and give us enough money to enter into final design with the FDA come late August of this year. If we receive less than that, we will have a difficult time making the minimum threshold that allows us to enter into final design. So that $70 million is extremely important, and I am here to tell you that is exactly what the number is. I don't know if you want more information or if you prefer to hear from the commissioners
and
or explain how we got to that.
Obviously, cutting from $140 million to $70 million was not something I wanted to do until I was told we don't jeopardize any federal money. So, Mr. McDonough, if you'd like to...
I would like to speak to that a little bit, Madam Chair and committee members. We're pleased that that council is using 70, but we would say the number should be $100 million. The $70 million does create some problems for the counties as far as how that cash flow is, because in August of 08, we have to have to FTA to keep this project moving. We have to have half of the local match nailed down. That's the state share and the county share from Ramsey and Hennepin County. And we understand what our commitment is. We know how we're going to make our share come forward. But it does cause us some problems when it's expected for us to put our money in up front.
And what is that amount, Mr. McKenna?
Now, since the transportation bill passed, I believe our total commitment will be $62, $63 million for Ramsey.
$91 million total. Between the two counties.
Right.
$62, $63 from Ramsey County and Mr. McLaughlin.
28 or 29 from us.
28
total of $91 million at a $910 million project scope range.
And one of the couple issues that I certainly need to point out, and we've got letters from our bond council that we forwarded on to the chairwoman, and we have them here, but certainly could get them out to committee members, but there is some problems if we're expected to bond and start investing some of these dollars when the project is not fully to the full funding grant agreement, and if some problems occur, the rating agencies will take a look at that and view this as more of a risk than a normal bond issue for Ramsey County, which could affect their AAA bond rating, which we've worked extremely hard to get. There's not many counties in the country actually that have that. And also there's an issue about if for some chance, and I'm sure all of us as partners will never get there, but you have to recognize that something could happen, and if this project would collapse, and we've already issued those bonds, there's some severe penalties if you have to go back and call those bonds back and deal with all those things. So from our perspective, we need that $100 million commitment from the state so that we can spend into this at a proportional rate to keep this project moving and not put Ramsey County and Hennepin County in an undue position to pay more up front than our share would require.
Mr. McLaughlin.
Thank you, Ms. Day. Peter McLaughlin, Chair of the Hennepin County Regional Railroad Authority. First, I just want to thank this committee. 10 years ago, this is the committee that started the process that got Hiawatha funded up and running as a bellwether project across the country. So I want to thank the committee and thank the chair for her role in that and the other members who were here. Secondly, we're talking about a commitment here to show that there is support at the state and metropolitan and local level for this project. We're competing against dozens of other projects across the country, and we need to have a solid financial backing here. $100 million would provide that dollar amount that we need to provide that signal so that we can effectively compete for the federal money, which is going to be half of the total cost of this project. So we would ask, as local officials, not only because of the local constraints under which we're operating, but also in order to enhance our ability to compete for the federal funds most effectively. That's value, that's dollars coming into the state, making the pie bigger. We would ask for the $100 million.
And Mr. Stettman, my understanding is your testimony is for $70 million this year, but you will have another opportunity next year. Is that correct, to lay out the full project?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I forgot to identify myself earlier. My name is Judd Stettman, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And Madam Chair, you're exactly right, and that has been expressed to the counties as well, that the Metropolitan Council has always been expected to have a share of the capital cost for this very important project. We were asking for $70 million this year. Based on funding scenarios, we will be back looking somewhere between, you know, $20 to $30 million, hopefully in the bonding bill next year. Now, as I know you're aware and the commissioners are aware, I work within the administration, and I will have to speak to the folks at the Department of Finance, and we'll be speaking with the governor on this as well. But it has always been expected that the state would have a share very similar to where we were looking at 140 before, and what happened with the transportation bill may have changed a little bit of that. But I don't want to give the impression to the committee that we believe that our share is satisfied with the $70 million, because it is not.
Representative Murphy has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just a little confused on the sharing part. For the counties, you're saying Ramsey has $63 million and needs, and Hennepin $29 million. And so if the state puts in $100 million, it's the $63 and the $29 part of the $100 million? Or is 63 and 29 your match to our 100 million?
Representative Murphy, Ramsey County always was expected to pay 98 million of the entire project. Hennepin County was always expected to pay 42 of the entire project. I think what they're suggesting is those two counties are going to fast track up front their money in order to meet the federal commitment. But the number that both counties were committed to in the total project remains the same. It's just when they pay that. Commissioner McGraw.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, we need both, because we have to show half of the non-federal share, so a quarter of the money we've got to have committed when the application goes in early September of this year. A quarter of the total cost of the project, which is $910 million plus or minus $50 million.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just wanted to revisit. I understand the testimony on the $70 million for this year, but then I heard two different numbers for the next year, 91 and 100. And what is the difference, or isn't there really a difference? And then Mr. Shetland said, well, next year we'll need from 20 to 30. So we seem to be expressing kind of a wide range there. And the way this bonding bill may come together this year, it's going to be tight, and maybe tight next year. And then just trying to get a handle on 91, 100, 20 to 30. What are you really telling us about the next biennium then?
Mr. Shetland.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the $70 million is a firm number for this year. The reason why I give a little wiggle room on the request for next year is because the project, the CEI, the Cost Effectiveness Index, can still shift a little bit, and if that shift occurs, then it affects the state share and the local share to the county. So that's why I'm just trying to say that it could be somewhere between $20 and $30 million to get us to the $90 to $100 million mark as an overall participation. Similar to where the counties are saying $91 million right now, I'm just giving myself $10 million of wiggle room for what we're talking about for a bonding request heading into the 2009 session. I hope that answers.
And members, I wasn't going to take much time, but because of the nature of it and the amount that we're going to cut with federal money at stake, I wanted us to have some agreement that $70 million is a good number for us. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, that's correct.
Thank you very much. And then, Madam Chair, I would move House File 3166.
The Chair moves House File 3166.
And Madam Chair, there is an amendment, an author's amendment in your packet, 3166A2.
Not quite yet. Yes,
not yet. We'll
come around to it.
Or we can wait for that.
Okay.
As well.
And would you like to move that also?
I'll move that. And it calls for a report to the legislature by January 15th of each even-numbered year of the Biomedical Science Research Facility project authorized under this section. The report must at a minimum include for each project the total cost, the number of researchers, research grants, and the amount of debt issued. And then the second section, any bonds or other obligations issued by the board under this act are not public debt of the state, and the full faith and credit and taxing powers of the state are not pledged for their payment or of any payment. This, I believe, is identical language that we included when we used the same mechanism for the stadium at the University of Minnesota. So that's my understanding of the origin of the language.
So Chair Hausman has moved the amendment H3166A2. Any questions from members? If not, all those in favor say aye.
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 So proceed.
Well, Madam Chair, we are delighted to be with you. Many in this audience came, was it last week, I think, when we were otherwise occupied on the floor. And I'm grateful that so many came back. It comes on the day of an economic forecast. And the news will certainly be about that. But the last time we had one of these forecasts, one of the messages coming out of this was, at a time like that, it is absolutely a time for a state to look at research and development. This is not a time, I would suggest, when we are turtles and pull our heads into a shell and sit there quietly hoping all the danger goes away, but in fact the car might come along anyway. That this is the time to go boldly forward with a vision about what this state can be and how it can lead in a very important area. So I think it is somehow appropriate that on a day of an economic forecast with bad news, that we talk about a hopeful future and one where we lay out a leadership role for the state of Minnesota. I believe President Brunich is going to start our testimony.
Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, and then proceed.
I'm Bob Brunich, President of the University of Minnesota. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hausman, I want to thank Representative Hausman for serving as the chief author of this bill in the House, and we're delighted to be here to present what I think is one of the most exciting visionary proposals that you will find anywhere in the United States today. As Representative Hausman indicated, we're going to talk about what we think is a part of the core essential infrastructure to support the future of Minnesota's economy and one of Minnesota's most vibrant and critically important industries, the biomedical sciences industry. Before I get started, I want to at least acknowledge some of the people who are here and all of the people who joined us. We have in attendance Regents from the University of Minnesota, Regent Del Fontac is here, Regent Maureen Cisneros is here, Regent Stephen Hunter, and Region Emeritus Maureen Reed is with us as well. We have, I believe, Gary Ballas, who's the chair of the Faculty Consultative Committee, and Emily Hoover, the vice chair, and Martin Sampson, who's the faculty representative here, and literally dozens and dozens of leading faculty, researchers, students, and alumni supporters of the university have shown up because of their belief that this is a proposal that's critically important to the future of the University of Minnesota and our state. Let me just make a few comments, and then I'm going to let some of my colleagues do the heavy lifting and explain some of the details of the proposal. But I think it's fair to ask the same question that Representative Hausman posed to you, and that is, why is this important and why now? Why does it make sense to do this at this time when Minnesota does face important difficulties? Why is it important to the University of Minnesota? Why is it important to the future of our state? And I would make this point, that if you look at the history of the University of Minnesota, and you look at the connection of our university to the state's economy and quality of life, the work that we're going to talk about today has been right in the very center of what has helped make Minnesota's economy one of the envies of the country and the envies of the world. We're going to talk about the biomedical sciences industries in Minnesota. Steve Osterley, who's Vice President for Research at Medtronic, has done a worldwide study in this area, and he reports that this is the second most vibrant industry cluster of its kind in the world. It is a cluster that has enjoyed 30% job growth in the last 10 years, and it's an industry that we need to support. We need the research and development and the innovation to support this industry. That's done at a place like the University of Minnesota. It's also a state that has enormous strength in this area. I mentioned Osterley's statistics, but if you think about it, it's Boston Scientific, it's Medtronic, it's Sanchude, it's 3M in the medical services industry. It's smaller companies like Sermonix or MGI Pharma. It is a very, very vast enterprise. In fact, some people have estimated that as many as 400 businesses and industries in Minnesota, all over the state of Minnesota, are in this biomedical sciences cluster. This is an area where we have enormous strength in what I call comparative advantage. Last year, university researchers brought in nearly $620 million in competitive grants and contracts, and about two-thirds of this amount funded research in this particular area. The Department of Commerce estimates that in Minnesota's private economy, you have about 40 jobs for every $1 million of competitive money that comes in through this means. And so you can see it has a tremendous impact even outside the state of Minnesota. Other states, other countries have discovered that it's absolutely critical to invest in this area. You only have to look at the country of Ireland and the economic renaissance that Ireland has experienced in the last few years to see what investment can really do to grow an economy and improve the quality of life of a country. But states in the United States, many of which do not have the comparative advantages and strength of Minnesota, realize that in the global economy they need to invest in this area. At the University of California, San Francisco, there's a $1.5 billion capital investment program in this area. Madison, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, to our east, sister institution in the Big Ten, is spending $750 million in capital investment in this area. New York just announced a $250 million investment program. North Carolina, $275 million. Oklahoma, $475 million. Oklahoma doesn't have anything close to the industry sectors that we have in Minnesota. So we think this proposal is visionary. We think it's exciting. We think it's respectful of the state's budget. It's phased over a 10-year period, as you'll hear about in just a moment. And we think it's an absolutely critical part of the state's infrastructure if we're going to keep ourselves competitive in the world economy in the future. What I'd like to do now is introduce Dr. Frank Serra. He's Senior Vice President for Academic Health, the Health Services and Programs at the University of Minnesota. And he'll outline sort of the heart of this proposal. And then I'll ask Vice President Sitzenreiter to come in and talk about the economics of the proposal in a very, very short presentation.
Thank you, President Brennan. Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
My name is Frank Zura. I'm the Senior Vice President for Health Sciences for the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. Please proceed.
It's a pleasure to address you today, and thank you, and Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to go from a larger view that President Brunick gave you to a more pragmatic view of why these facilities now at this university. The simple answer is we have a big problem. We can recruit faculty, almost any faculty that we want. We're very good at that. There are many faculty in this room, and I think if you could talk to them, they'll tell you why they came here. It's the interdisciplinary research. It's the chance to grow and develop. It's the ability to look at their research space that they're going to be able to perform their research in. So that we can do. The problem we have now is we're out of space to recruit them into. So the building you funded the last time, the molecular bioscience building, is on time and on budget, and those faculty will fill it when it opens. So this is not a productivity issue for us. We measure productivity in research by the amount of grant dollars raised per faculty, so research dollars per faculty. Our productivity of our research faculty has never been higher in the history of the university. So we don't have that problem. What we have is this capacity issue. And to recruit the faculty, we need the facilities. In today's market, and that's what it is, the competition is keen for research dollars. Our faculty have increased an average of 8%. Our national research competitive awards, in spite of the fact that federal funding is flat or decreasing. In areas where we have focused investments, we have a 40 to 45% increase in awards, again pointing to the productivity. If you also talk to some of the faculty in this room, they will tell you they didn't come here the first time we asked them. It took us 2-3 years to go through the process, and we really needed to show them where they could do this kind of research. And that kind of lead time is the key ingredient to success, that kind of predictability. The next slide will show you what it is we're actually proposing to build. There are 4 buildings. We originally asked for 5. 1 is being built. There are these 4 left. We can complete these 4 facilities in the next 5 years. We've gone through that exercise at the university, and we're confident we can do it. And what you see in front of you is the schedule by project for design, construction, and move-in. The first one is the Center for Magnetic Resonance Research. This is a world-class group of faculty, hands down, acknowledged by everybody in the world. We need to keep it that way so that they can continue the imaging research in such areas as Alzheimer's disease, cancer, and neurobehavioral disorders. This particular project is 56,000 total gross square feet, 53 million, and will house 10 new principal investigators. The second project is the Cancer Biomedical Research Building. This building is about the translational research in such areas as breast, lung, colon, and prostate cancer. It would be approximately 120,000 gross square feet, would cost about $85 million and would house 40 new principal investigators. Incidentally, these cost figures are inflated to the midpoint of construction, so you can see how that works. The third project is the Lilly High Biomedical Research Building, which is a translational research facility to house faculty looking for the next generation of ways to prevent and cure heart disease. This will house 40 new principal investigators, cost approximately $86 million, and again be 120,000 square feet. We're actually using as a template for these buildings one that we have used now twice, worked exceedingly well, and we know how to really manage the construction. The fourth project is the Infectious Disease and Neuroscience Biomedical Research Building, 90,000 gross square feet, about $68 million, and will house about 30 new principal investigators. What comes out the other side from this investment? Probably something important to know on a day like today. This is truly an economic investment. One, new ways to prevent and cure disease. That, I think you've heard a lot about. The other piece is new technologies for commercialization in Minnesota. If Vice President Mulcahy is here today, he can answer questions about that. I can simply attest at this point that what he's done to transform the university's technology commercialization process is truly remarkable. It is now well interfaced with our industrial sector, and industrial relations is a university priority. We think just from the new federal money, we could receive about $120 million in new awards, and we're very confident that we would continue the trend for an increase in private sector money, private sector research grants, private donation support, and foundation support as an additional way to leverage these federal dollars. By way of jobs, the facilities project itself would create 4,800 new jobs, permanent new jobs. We just received another number this morning about construction jobs for these five buildings. Each building would support 200 new construction workers. So that's 800 new jobs for the duration of the project. We already know it's attracting new venture capital to the state of Minnesota. This kind of a process and the state getting behind this development for the biosciences in Minnesota has attracted a lot of new venture money into the state, looking at new startup companies and looking at and purchasing land around these facilities and around the rest of Minnesota as a reception area to accelerate the commercialization of technology and new startup companies. And I think this last reason is one I would simply point out. This is critical to retain Minnesota's position as a world leader in biotechnology. And with that, I will turn the podium to Mr. Pfitzenreuther to explain the finances that are inherent in this undertaking.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and would you state your name for the record? And then,
sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Pfitzenreuther. I go by Fitz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota and a former House employee. I left in 92.
And please, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, this biomedical research program legislation is one in which it's a state, a state program to finance four new research facilities. The University of Minnesota, the Board of Regents, will be responsible for issuing the bonds for the total cost of these four projects, $292.0 million. It creates an 80-20 partnership between the state and the university to pay back those bonds that, again, are issued by the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. The state share of the construction will be $232.6 million, and the university share $58.4 million. The legislation establishes a schedule and a maximum level of annual state appropriations that are sufficient from the state to pay the debt service on the $233.6 million of bonds issued by the state. This next slide shows you the actual schedule of appropriations in the bill. These are maximum appropriations by fiscal year. It ramps up in this manner because that's how capital projects ramp up. The these four projects will phase in 2-year increments, and the university's Board of Regents will issue this debt in a series of bond offerings, and this is an estimate based on the cash flows that are required to construct those four projects. The next slide shows you, not to bring the stadium issue back into the legislative venue, but shows you that when we planned and are now constructing the TCF Bank Stadium, that the university also invested approximately $18 million of its resources in preparing the infrastructure around the stadium for these buildings. We spent additional money cleaning up environmental issues outside the stadium site. We constructed roads, sewers, surface water, retention ponds to get this site ready to take these buildings. We are, as I said, we are ready to construct these buildings. There are no land acquisition issues. There are no additional infrastructure issues at hand, and we're ready to go as soon as this legislation is enacted. And with that, Madam Chair and members, I'll stand for any questions on this or any of the rest of my colleagues.
And Madam Chair, if the committee is willing, I would prefer if we could get all the testimony before we go to questions, if the chair and members, if that's the way you'd like to proceed, we will. Thank you for that. Are we coming back to Mr. Sarah?
Madam Chair, I would like to introduce to you Dan Gary, who's the St. Jude Professor and Director of the Lilly High Heart Institute and Division Director for Cardiology, who would like to address you for a couple of minutes.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Gary. Would you state your name for the record and then proceed?
My name is Dan Gary, and Madam Chair, committee members, I'm pleased to be here today, and I'm also a native Minnesotan. I'm a product of the University of Minnesota, having received my MD-PhD, and for the past 15 years I've been down in Dallas at UT Southwestern Medical Center, and it's a privilege to return to my alma mater and to help lead the cardiovascular enterprise. As many of you know, the cardiovascular program at the University of Minnesota has had a rich history of pioneering initiatives. In 1951, there was a heart building that was established. And this heart building brought together both physicians as well as scientists that revolutionized cardiovascular care. 3 years after building this building, the first open heart surgical procedure was undertaken in the world. And this revolutionized cardiovascular care. 7 years later, the first transistorized pacemaker was implanted at the University of Minnesota, the first one worldwide. This was done in collaboration and ultimately led to the genesis of several companies, Medtronic and St. Jude Medical, that went on to also revolutionize patient care, not only for this state, but also worldwide as well. Well, today, the University of Minnesota is also a world leader in heart failure. Heart failure is the number one disease. We spend more than $50 billion as an economy towards the treatment of heart failure, and we're the world's leader. We undertake robotic surgical procedures. We utilize cell therapy. We're among the world leaders in this area, and the University of Minnesota is a world leader at the Stem Cell Institute. This year, we're celebrating our 30-year anniversary for heart transplantation at the University of Minnesota. We're a world leader in heart transplantation. We're the number one program for mechanical pumps, that is, producing or allowing for these technologies to improve the quality of care for patients with end-stage heart disease and support them as a bridge towards transplantation. In addition, not only focusing on these outstanding areas to treat patients with chronic disease, but we're focused on the next generation. So, at the University of Minnesota, we've discovered new ways in combination with cardiovascular genomics to identify our children who are at risk for heart disease and stroke and heart attack and initiate therapies to prevent those adverse events. So all this was possible with a new building in 1951. So now we're 57 years later. And the Lilly High Heart Institute now has investigators in three separate buildings. And it's absolutely essential to bring investigators together to have this research space for innovation and discovery, to retain our outstanding faculty and to recruit faculty. Now, our geographical neighbors, Iowa, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio State, all have brand new cardiovascular buildings. They're in place, 2 years old. They all have greater than 120,000 square feet of research laboratory space. The institution that I came from, UT Southwestern Medical Center, has 7 new buildings in 12 years, all greater than 150,000 square feet of laboratory space. That's our competition. That's our competition to retain our faculty. That's our competition to recruit these outstanding faculty. This is our Midwest competition. This is absolutely essential. For the Lone Star State, we should be leading in this area of innovation and discovery. I'm new here. I've returned. This is after 15 years. This is very exciting for me. My wife will understand this.
And I just have to correct you. It is the North Star State. it was just bothering everyone.
As I said, I've got a lot to learn. having said that, I've got family of 4 children. I'm looking for a house. And it's not that I'm going to find 3 houses to house my children. Everybody would say, well, that's ridiculous. Nobody can thrive and reach their full potential. And just like our institute, you need to bring these investigators together. They need to appreciate the efficiency of very expensive equipment as opposed to reproducing that expensive equipment. Junior faculty members that we recruit need to be supported by more seasoned investigators. And importantly, we need to collaborate. And that's typically done shoulder to shoulder, working together. So I believe that these building initiatives are absolutely essential. They need to be here today, not 3 years from now. And so I would strongly urge you to invest and to allow for the University of Minnesota to lead in innovation and discovery. So that I'll stop and take any questions.
I think we're going to wait for questions until the end. Was that accurate, Representative Hauser?
I think they're all going to stay. So the next one then would be Dale Wallstrom, CEO, Bio Business Alliance. He's never
going to
live that down.
No. And I have to say thank you to him for presenting us with some levity. We enjoyed that. So please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Chair and Committee members. My name is Dale Walton. I am currently the CEO of the BioBusiness Alliance of Minnesota. Prior to that, I was Vice President and General Manager of one of the business units for Medtronic. I became involved in this initiative of the bioscience industry many years ago, but became deeply involved about 3.5 years ago when the Bio-Business Alliance was initiated by the governor at that time. And we are focused on helping to help the state understand the revolution or the evolution that's taking place within the bioscience industry. So. And I apologize to people in the audience. I did not expect this many people to be here, so I don't have enough hard copies. So I'm going to be talking about this, which you all have. In front of you, and for those in the audience, if you didn't get one, please try to share with one somebody next to you who did get one. But what this graph, this first graph that I showed you when it's colored, is a graph of how we view the bioscience industry in the state. And the way we think about this, first of all, is that, and what the genesis of this whole effort is that we recognize that the world is entering the age of biology. And that every tech, we're not leaving the age of information, we are taking and capitalizing on the information age and learning how to work within the world of biology to create new jobs. And the industries we have here, such as Hayden, as was alluded to earlier, the Medtronic of the world, the St. Jude's of the world, are being impacted by this change quite significantly already. So the way to provide a little background, and again, I want to apologize one last time to those who don't have a copy of this, but the graph at the top that has the 6 triangles, this represents the world of the private sector. There are companies are created, jobs are created, etc. The bottom three boxes underneath that represent the world of the citizen, the community. We call this community capability. The very bottom box, the orange box, represents the world of the public sector. By that we talk about our K-12 education, our infrastructure, our policies are appropriately positioned to help grow and maintain health industry all fit into that. The green box right above that represents the role of the academic community. This is what we call enabling knowledge clusters, things like catalysis, synthesis, nanotechnology, bioengineering, imaging navigation, some of the topics that you've heard presented here earlier today. This enabling knowledge cluster area is the basis from which we can compete. It's what our citizens, our institutions, basic capabilities to create knowledge that can be turned into companies and jobs and economic wealth. Right above that, we have a large box which we call the commercialization catalyst, and those represent a convergence between the academic, the public, and the private sector, where we enable the transference of knowledge from the knowledge clusters into active job creation. And what the BioBusiness Alliance, it is not our policy or our tradition to come and advocate for any one investment. We're breaking from that tradition on this one, and I invite you to turn to page 2. And the reason for breaking from that tradition is that when you look at the circles around all the various areas of investment that are necessary to create a total community that can compete, you notice that there are very few of the knowledge creation clusters, there are a few of the commercialization clusters, areas, and its basic education. They're all impacted by the nature of this investment. So for that reason, we have elected to break from our tradition of not advocating for any more investment, and we are advocating very strongly for this one. There is no investment that we are aware of that's been asked for that touches more areas of need within the state. Because when you look at our mission and our function of our group as a nonprofit, we really are wholesalers, so to speak. We try to look back across the state, understand how these various aspects of the community capability serve to create jobs and companies within the state, because that's what we're about, is job creation. And when we find something that fills holes in our capability, not only for today, but as we look to the future, we try to get some momentum around that. And there's nothing we have seen that creates more momentum and more capability for long-term value as we take in this one. Hence, we are getting behind it. In the sake of time, I'm going to ask you to skip over the third slide and go straight to the fourth slide. This is an important slide to us, because as we look at job growth and economic wealth, creation of economic wealth for the community, we don't just look at the metro area or just those who work in certain geographic entities. Rather, we're looking across the state. And one of the things that we're working very hard with organizations such as University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, and others, is to learn how to take this knowledge and working within their institution, their institutional infrastructure, but also within the private sector and the local economic development infrastructure, to take that knowledge and make it available across the state. So whether you're living in Bemidji or Duluth or somewhere in the metro area, Bloomington, whatever, or in the southeast, southwest, you have equal access and equal ability to leverage the capabilities that are created by this. And this is a very important aspect of this type of investment that you're considering. And I would, as a citizen of the state, who is not tied directly to this particular institution, I would really urge you to do everything in your power to try to get this through. So it's a very important issue. So with that, I want to thank you very much for the time and your attention.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And looking at this map, it just reminds me of the capital investment tours that we took this summer. And so we understand what you're saying about all the parts of the state.
And then Representative Hausman. Chair Don Gerhart, CEO Life Science Alley. Welcome to the committee. Would you please state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Gerhart. I'm the CEO of Life Science Alley here in the Twin Cities.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much for spending time with us this afternoon on this really key question. And again, you'll hear someone supporting this very, very important vote that'll be coming at you. And we want to answer all your questions. And again, thank you for your time. Again, I'm Don Gerhart, CEO of Life Science Alley. Life Science Alley is a Minnesota-based trade association in the life sciences and the biosciences that has over 570 business and other organizational members. Those 570 members employ about a quarter of a million Minnesotans. I interact with a lot of them every day, so I feel that I and my staff have a pretty good pulse on what's going on in the state, in the bioscience, life science world. So I'd like to tell you today some of the things that we see and try to translate that information to you. Our focus then is on medical technology and biotechnology and healthcare providers as well as insurers. So we have a broad band of both experience and information and membership in our membership base. I'm going to leap directly to the main subject. If we want to, if Minnesota wants to continue to participate in the very, very fast-moving and quickly changing life science, bioscience world, we need to move decisively, wisely, and efficiently to keep the very positive world-class assets that we now have. We need to keep them, and then we need to keep them at a competitive level. This funding proposal is a perfect example of a call to action for all of us across the aisle, the citizens, the people that produce the technology. We need to really answer to this call for action. So I've personally been in some of the facilities that other people have talked about today. I've been at the University of Colorado, at the Fitzsimmons Army Base translation into the new University of Colorado Hospital, and about 9 cancer research buildings built around that. I've been at the University of Michigan and what's going on there. I've been at the University of Wisconsin and seen their tech transfer in their research park that now employs over 5,800 people directly out of spin-outs from their life science biomedical world. I've been at the University of San Francisco. I've seen what's going on at Columbia. I've seen what's going on at Purdue. I've been in China. I've been in Scotland. I've been at Great Britain, and I've been in Ireland to see what's going on in this world of bioscience, life science, and we need to keep up. We have an incredible, incredible asset here, so we need to take care of it. We need to keep feeding it. So, next point. Our biomedical company, over 300 out of that 570 I talked about, are biomedical manufacturers and developers here in the state of Minnesota. They rely heavily. In fact, we can't find anybody. We honestly can't find people in our membership that are not very, very reliant on the University of Minnesota, both its research and the students it puts out for their well-being and their existence. We have to keep those students. We have to keep another kind of hidden asset. As we talk about the major researchers have relatively large staff, and in those staff they have postdocs that aren't considered necessarily students, but they're incredibly fertile investments into our community. Our companies hire a lot of postdocs that come out of the research and can bring all of that knowledge immediately into the business. So finally, just today, the state of Massachusetts let it be known very publicly that they're very, very concerned about their biomedical cluster. And we're number 2, they're number 1 in size, and they're very concerned about losing parts of that biomedical cluster, and they're just going to a major new investment, upping the investment they just made in the last couple of years. So the competitive issues are fierce,
We don't need to have to battle with the California and others, but we need to lever our assets. This is one way to do it, and this is extremely important. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then, Madam Chair, I think you have a special interest in our last presenter, the Vice President of Corporate Human Resources from St. Jude Medical.
Yes, Representative Hausman, and we're very glad to have him here. And I just have to say that this is a Minnesota company whose world headquarters is about 7 miles straight north of this capital. And we're very glad to have you here. And would you state your name for the record, please?
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Bay. I'm the Vice President of Human Resources for St. Jude Medical in Little Canada. Thank you for letting us participate in today's proceeding.
Please proceed.
As many of you already know, St. Jude Medical is a medical device company with corporate and international headquarters in Minnesota. Our 12,000 employees around the world and approximately 2,200 in Minnesota have made it our mission to bring products to the healthcare community that will treat patients who suffer from cardiac, neurological, and chronic pain conditions. Our partnership with the University of Minnesota, like many of our competitors, is a crucial part of the story of our evolution as a company. On October 3, 1977, in a surgery at the University of Minnesota, the first St. Jude Medical heart valve was implanted into a Minnesota patient. Since that time, our company has evolved from a startup heart valve company in 1976 to a $3.8 billion global business. Today, in each of our product treatment areas, we continue to collaborate with the university. As a business, we're focused on growth and the future in the areas of cardiac rhythm management and in the fields of atrial fibrillation and neuromodulation. We're even working on creating the next generation of heart valves. We're growing, expanding in Minnesota and elsewhere, and we have recently publicly predicted that we expect our revenue to double over the next 5 years. In order to be ready for the growth that we expect, we are in the process of expanding our headquarters location in Little Canada with an expected 600 additional jobs at that location. We recently completed an expansion of our cardiovascular division across the 36th Freeway Highway. We have large facilities in Minnetonka and a presence in Maple Grove and St. Paul. We expect within our 20-year Minnesota expansion plan to need many, many additional Minnesota-based employees, particularly in research and development and other related scientific roles. We continue to believe that the university's education and training is critical to the maintenance and growth of the life science industry and to our business. The research pioneered in the past that is no doubt still taking place today and that we expect to occur in the future will lead us to new cures and treatments for patients as well as job and economic growth in our state. We at St. Jude Medical are pleased to be here to support the continued evolution and success of the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we're at the end of our testifiers, I believe, and so we're ready for questions, and Representative Borgenius has the first question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate so many folks coming out, and I appreciate the vision, and I'll be supporting it. However, as I look at this, there's one thing that's troubling me greatly. I look at the diseases we're looking at, Alzheimer's, various kinds of cancers, heart disease, stroke, and these are all diseases of an aging population. And what's missing here is a concentration on children. And this is our future. And that's extraordinarily troubling to me. And here's, in the state, we spend tons of money. And we need to spend tons of money because we have so many children with learning disabilities. This is just an example. We need to study that. We need to understand those kinds of things that affect children. So I'm interested in knowing if you're going to be bringing to us other proposals that are as important to our children as these proposals are to our aging population.
And Mr. Sheriff.
Madam Chair, representative members of the committee, I thank you for this question. I think it is a key question, and time constraints really didn't allow me to elaborate on programs, so let me talk about how this relates to children's programs. First of all, many of the areas of research focus all pertains to children and will have children's research in them. Neuroimaging as an example. One of the major projects there is to look at how does the brain change from birth onwards in the development of childhood mental health disorders, autism being an example. That research already is revolutionizing that particular disease, to say nothing of the other addictions that we know are big problems for us, the other mental health diseases, and the more organic-based diseases, if you will, such as diabetes. Diabetes in kids is an enormous problem. That's a big part of this research project and a big part of the emphasis in our Department of Pediatrics. I'll point out something else here. One of the areas of research has to do with the immune system and how it's turned on and off. Big problem in kids for a variety of diseases. Not only are the pediatricians coming together, but they're doing it with the engineers and the computational biologists, and they've already come up with a new approach that will be going into clinical testing. So there's another example of this. And I think we could just keep right on going. And probably the best way for me to finalize this, and I can get you as much additional information as you wish, is that when we think about disease, we've kind of organized ourselves into modules or corridors. You've heard the one about cancer, you've heard the one about heart disease, we have metabolic disease such as diabetes. There's also another one we didn't talk about today, which is diseases of children. Pediatrics, call it what you will, which is a whole other area of emphasis of our faculty from the College of Liberal Arts, through psychology, through engineering, through the medical school, and through the other health sciences schools. So I think your point is well made. I believe it to be very well covered here, and the recruitment of people doing research in this area is clearly a part of the plan.
Did you have a follow-up, a representative? To talk about this plan, I just see the disease of an aging population. I understand the U is doing other things too, but I think we publicly have to work on and talk about and educate the public about the things that I think are extraordinarily important. Because if we continue to spend so much money on educating children where they have learning disabilities of some sort, that's money you don't get in the end. And that's a problem. Because we just see that expanding so fast.
Madam Chair, representative, members of the committee, I could not agree with you more. You're absolutely correct. Probably if I thought about it a little more, I would have put some childhood diseases on here instead of saying cancer. So please accept my apology for that, and we will change the public discourse on it.
Thank you for that, Dr. Chair. We appreciate that. Next question is from Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, my question is for Mr. Fitzenreiter. And Mr. Fitzenreiter, I'll have to pardon my cold. Maybe we should have testimony on what you can do for the common cold. There's several of us around the table, but be that as it may, I'll try to, hopefully my voice will last long enough to answer the question. But Mr. Fitzenreiter, you and I and others, Chair Representative Hausman, we had some discussion about the 3% limit and using this technique, and I think it's important today to hear the university's perspective on how you feel that 3% limit should be calculated, and the information that you shared with us that you had gotten from the bond houses and how they would perceive the 3% limit. And I ask that in light of some of the discussions earlier today with finance and so on as the result of a smaller state budget.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure whether all members of the committee have had a chance to read the letter that was submitted to the leadership from Commissioner Hansen at the Finance Department. In that letter, there's a particular statement that I'd like to read to you, and then explain to you why I think that particular statement is true but doesn't really apply specifically in this case. The quote of the letter is, "The careful crafting of this bill may provide technical rationale for separate consideration, but from a financial management perspective, there is no doubt that these buildings would be part of the state's overall debt obligations and should be treated accordingly." I think that statement is absolutely true, and the University of Minnesota has never suggested otherwise. The stadium bill that was passed by the legislature had an effect on the state's credit rating. This biomed bill will as well. What I think the finance department got wrong is which debt management guideline applies to this transaction. And I want to explain why I think the 3% guideline does not apply. Again, I want to remind you that there are 5 debt management guidelines of the state of Minnesota. The legislature gets the most attention is put on the 3% guideline. But I will tell you that one precedent as to why I think it doesn't apply is that at the time the stadium bill was created, consultation with the Department of Finance, Peter Salzen and Peggy Ingerson at the time, concluded that the 3% rule for the stadium bill did not apply. The biomed proposal was crafted and constructed in exactly the same manner. We agreed on this approach because there was precedent for it not to be treated as part of the 3%. I know, and we all know, the rules can change, and I guess they're deciding to change them. But there's a second precedent I think is important as to why it doesn't apply, and that's that all the debt, to my knowledge, that's ever been issued by the state of Minnesota and applied to the 3% guideline has been debt that's been issued specifically in the name of the state of Minnesota, the general obligation debt of the state of Minnesota, and carries the full faith and credit and taxing powers of the state behind those bonds. This bill, like the stadium bill, to construct these 4 biomed facilities, will be issued in the name of the regents of the University of Minnesota, not in the name of the state. They are not geo-debt and do not carry the full faith and credit and taxing powers of the state. I have no problem with the language that was inserted earlier to clarify that. That identical language was included in the stadium bill. Now, despite these 2 important precedents as to why I think the 3% doesn't apply, I think it's important for the legislature to understand that there is a debt management guideline that does apply to this transaction. And that debt guideline reads, the total amount of state general obligation debt, moral obligation debt, state bond guarantees, equipment leases, and real estate leases are not to exceed 5% of state personal income. That's the 4th guideline of 5 guidelines by the state. Now let me explain why I think the stadium bill and the new biomed proposal have a credit implication that makes that 4th guideline come into play. When the stadium, I thought I'd never have to talk about the stadium debt. When the stadium debt was issued, both Standard & Poor's and Moody's viewed that debt and wrote in their rating of that debt that that debt was a limited obligation of the University of Minnesota. Not entirely not an obligation, but a limited obligation. And that's due to the fact that there was a statutory appropriation from the state that made the annual payments and were pledged to meet the debt service on those bonds. That said, the real implications for the university, remember, these bonds have been issued in the name of the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota, is that there's a risk that there'll be a non-appropriation, that you will stop that appropriation by law. You can go in and undo it. And if that happens, because, again, the state's not legally obligated to make the stadium debt, please don't repeal it, nor are you really legal, you are not legally obligated to pay the annual amount. It's a risk the university's taking. If the state fails to make that payment, the fact is the university would have to step in and make that payment. We have a moral obligation as well as the state. And let me explain the state's obligation. And remember, if you didn't make that payment, the university would have to make that payment, in my judgment, because if we didn't, the marketplace would come in and say, you know, university, we're going to punish you. We're not going to buy your bonds in the future because you didn't make that payment. That's a risk we took in the deal, and we understood that. The state, by the virtue of that annual statutory appropriation, also faces a credit risk here, in that if the state didn't make that appropriation, and remember, you don't legally have to, you can undo it, but in my judgment, if you didn't make that appropriation, and the university said, gee, sorry, bondholders, the state cut the money, you're out the money, I think that the rating agencies and the bond market are going to punish both of us. So in that sense, even though you're not legally obligated because you can wipe out the appropriation, I think the state faces a moral obligation to pay that debt. And that's where I think the fourth condition, fourth guideline comes into play. If the state didn't make that appropriation, I think there's going to be ramifications. But again, I think there's earlier precedent that says the 3% guideline doesn't come into play. This fourth guideline comes into play. Now, the reality is I think this credit risk for the state and for the university is small. Let's be honest here. We get well over $600 million a year from the state of Minnesota, and I would imagine, now I'm going to get in trouble with the president, but I imagine you're going to cut our appropriations because of the budget shortfall, and I don't think it'll ever be to the point, however, that you actually go in and cut or reduce the appropriation for the stadium, or that you would cut the appropriation for the biomed proposal. So even though I'm telling you there's a credit risk, I think the likelihood of that coming into play is fairly minimal. Just in concluding, as the Department of Finance stated in its letters, the proposal has been carefully crafted. But please bear in mind that the state has 5 debt management guidelines, not just one, and this bill has been constructed with those guidelines in mind. The debate, in my mind, is not about whether or not this proposal has an impact on the state. It does. It has an impact both on its cost, because you're providing an appropriation, but also that credit risk, although I think it's small. The question from my perspective is, if the state is going to have 5 debt guidelines, are we going to use those guidelines to our maximum advantage to accomplish something that's important for the state? Or are we just going to use one? Then in my judgment, why have 5 guidelines?
Thank you for that question.
Madam Chair, since the letter from Mr. Hansen was referenced, we're having that passed out to you, and we did invite him to come today. He wasn't able to, but Jane Rankin did come, and they're certainly available here should the committee want to ask them.
And Madam Chair, a conclusion to my question, because we'd had those earlier discussions and this letter had come out, I felt it was important that we hear the university's perspective on that, because it has been a point of discussion, obviously, as a result of the letter. So thank you.
That was a good question, Mr. Carlson, Representative Carlson. Thank you. The next question is Representative Goldberg.
To that point, Mr. Pitzenreiter. Yes? I have in front of me the charts of the 5% and so forth, and we're at about the 3%. We also had some creative financing a few years ago that is on the mall of the Capitol complex, and that's we had the St. Paul Port Authority sell bonds for the Anderson Building and the Freeman Building. I think that's the name of the two buildings. And we are paying off those bonds with rent, in other words. It's part of our general obligation as well. Although I think there is, if the state collapsed and we didn't have any money for them, probably the St. Paul Port Authority would indeed have the moral obligation. But again, they should be counted as part of the overall state obligation. In the chart that we're down to, that 5% of the total,
down to about 3 or 2.96, 3.00, going out 3.12. Do you know if in your calculations of that, are those obligations in that particular figure as well?
Madam Chair Member, my reading of the fourth guideline that I referred to does include leases in that calculation. Okay. Leases of the state.
And, Madam Chair, we always get additional information. Does that include leases that that an agency would rent from just a building that they may lease on a short-term basis? I think in the Anderson and the Freeman building, we probably have a long-term lease, although I think there are some restrictions on the amount of time that we can lease or other things. There may be an exception to that.
Madam Chair, members, I can only tell you that at the University of Minnesota, the rating agencies do factor in long-term leases when they analyze our debt capacity. And I'm sure the state gets treated the same way.
And, Madam Chair, just one other thing. There's one more chart that I'm passing out. And this is, we many times refer to the 3% limit. And this is the end of session, May session. And I want to pass this out to people to look at the historical. We've always been at, our obligation is at 3% that we passed the authorization for. But we're finding out much more information on how that 3% is calculated. And you'll see historically, even though we have authorized what we think is 3%, there are other factors that involve. And that's because we do an estimate of income to the state. We do an estimate of personal income. And if we just, this is just the one that was out just on the 3%. Even though we thought each of the years we were at 3% debt capacity, we were really only at 2.73% in the projected. This projection on the last one is based on 645, based on, as I understand it, 120 last year and 645 this coming year. So that when you see the 10, 11, and 8, 9, it's based on those two particular figures. But we didn't have 120 in the first year, so I don't know how that flows. But if you go back for that in history, from 94 on, I've been here, we've always had that 3% as our limiting thing, and you'll see what actually turns into be our debt capacity in historic. So I think Representative or Mr. Fitzenreiter is correct in that we need to look at all obligations and manage our debt carefully.
Representative Hausman.
And Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, we happen to have the same chart before us in the governor's office this morning and talked about the 08, 09, and 10, 11 and observed that they are, in fact, forecasted amounts. And if you look at the reality, I mean, the rest of it, 94 to 07, that's reality. The last two are forecasts.
Right.
One could probably make an assumption that those two bars will not be as high.
Next question. Any further questions on that chart? Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair, this bill, of course, is going to be laid open for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, but there is one amendment that a member has that it would seem appropriate, perhaps, to add now.
Oh, I'm sorry.
More questions.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, for Dr. Serra, probably, mi amico, paisan. You know, Dr. Serra, you talked about your pragmatic view and that we've got a big problem in keeping up. And now let me give you my pragmatic view as a legislator. We got a huge problem that was presented to us today, and that is a $952 million deficit, which is projected in the next biennium when this funding source starts to be, with inflation, $2.1 billion. Now, currently, your request of $230 million approximately in the bonding bill is over a quarter of the bonding bill, and my understanding is the governor doesn't even like the size of our bonding bill at $920 million. So, you know, I have to, in my higher education and workforce development committee, Representative Hausman, and you know this, I'm carrying, Mr. Fitzenritter, correct me if I'm wrong, but a little over $10 million now a year in the stadium.
Mr. Chairman, 10.2.
10.2, what's a couple hundred grand, right?
Yeah, but,
you know, I've got the $8 million annually for the biogenomics project that we gave to the Rochester and the university. And with this, for over 20 years, I have to carry $16.5 million in the base. Now, that's over $70 million a biennium, you know, that of money that is going to be in that base of the higher education committee that could go for a lot of other things. And, you know, I there's a lot more brilliant minds than me sitting out there, from President Brunink and you to probably almost everyone in this room, in fact. But, you know, we have a lot of requests in the bonding bill. We have people that have want money for public facility authority that are paying, I know of a little community paying $200 a month if we don't help them to go to the bathroom on their sewer bill. We've got all kinds of requests, and we don't have that much money. In fact, one of the requests that we'll be talking about as we put this bill together, ironically, is for a steel mill where, when they mine the ore, you're going to get probably $100 million for your Furman University fund. So, you know, help me out, because you are a lot smarter than I am. What's fair? You know, we have all these requests. We've got this money I have to carry for 20 years, more than 20 years, but $16.5 million for 20 years in the bill, higher ed bill. And we ask the Minsky system, as an example, to pay a third. We ask you to pay a third of the bonding. I don't necessarily agree with that, but that's the way it is. But help me out. What should I do? I think that you have, this is my personal opinion, that you have the wherewithal. One of your buildings has already been named. There obviously is money coming in on that building for the naming rights, I guess, for lack of a better word. I think you have the wherewithal to be a little more than the 80-20 proposal here. But, you know, we have problems in this state, problems with our revenue source that I think are going to continue. And I'll probably, looking around this table, there aren't six people in this table that would want to tax people fairly anymore. We got a governor that taxes the hell out of everybody but says he doesn't raise taxes. So give me some advice. What should I do, Dr. Sarah, or President Brunink, or Mr. Fitzner? What should we do here? Because I think we can squeeze a little more out of you and still help you out, because I will finish by saying that you do a wonderful, wonderful job. You could do a better job, but you do a wonderful job. But there's only so much money to work with, and right now you're asking for a really huge chunk of money. So help me out.
So, Dr. Sarah, are you going to tackle that one?
Madam Chair, I'm going to begin. I'm sure Mr. Fitzenrutter would like to weigh in, and I'm absolutely certain President Brunick will. So, my colleague from the range, Representative Rukavina, I think raises a very important point. Apropos of our previous discussion of this issue, I think this was much more nicely framed and is very clear.
I can't exhibit that type of behavior publicly, but.
So I would like to give several levels of answers and then see what my colleagues want to do. There's no question this is an important issue, but I think the context is also important. I understand everybody has problems, everybody needs problems solved. I think what you're hearing in this proposal is about the future. And there are kind of two ways to approach the future. You can cut your way out of it, in my opinion, in which case you end up smaller and with the same problem you started with, or you can invest your way out of it. We're talking here about economic investment. An economic investment takes a period of years to pay off, but at the end of it is jobs, new companies, new business, support of our current world-dominant device industry, and the continued health of the state. The same way some groups, such as us, 30, 40 years ago, certainly before I came to this state, had the foresight and the fortitude to make those investments. And my history of the reading of the state was there are ups and downs in the economy, and I suspect our children are going to go through the same thing. But investment is critical for the future, and that's what this program is about. And I think if you talk to the economists, in times of a threatened downturn, investment is a good thing to do. It's probably the only sure way to beat the problem in the short run and the long run. Point number two. The other thing about this project is it attracts new dollars. It keeps new dollars in the state, it attracts new dollars in the state, and should down the way create revenue. At one point in my thinking about this, I had entertained engaging one of the economists to figure out what that might be, but I didn't get to that. But it's certainly an economic development exercise that could be undertaken. And I think the last time you heard me speak about this was in the context of the University Mayo Partnership and the economic investment result we had Trip Umbach make for you. And I think if you recollect that or bring it out, you'll see that that kind of an investment, which was on a much smaller scale, had many-fold returns. So that's kind of that. Another piece of information, as I'm kind of winding into your question here, is this. We've actually fully cost accounted these research buildings. I'll be the first to tell you, research in this lab is expensive. You already know that from what we ask. The building that we need for life sciences takes up most of the university's funding request. That's why we looked for an alternative that was in the context of a long-range investment for the entire state so everybody could benefit. When you fully load the revenues and the expenses, the university actually ends up paying about 50% of these costs. We have to pick up other costs of the recruitment, retention of faculty, the costs that are not covered by many research grants, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my recollection of that number. And I would remind you, and I'm going to pass the ball here now to my colleague on the left, that we started out this proposal with a 90-10, and then this time backed it to an 80-20.
Madam Chair, just members, I just wanted to give the committee the knowledge in this debate about it's currently 80-20. If it was the wisdom of the committee, we don't advocate it, we like the proposal as is, to two-thirds, one-third. It shifts in the upward, remember, this is really a tail issue, it's not a current biennium issue. In the next biennium, the cost of the proposal at the 80-20 is about $5 million. A revision to two-thirds, one-third would reduce that amount to approximately $4 million. And over the, when it's fully ramped in, it would shift $2.7 million away from the state side of the ledger on an annual basis and towards the university. So that's just the numbers that we're talking about here.
Well, Mr. Fichtenreiter, and you're right. Immediately, there's not that big of an obligation in 2010 and 11. It goes from 900,000 the first year to 3.8, or almost 3.9 the second year, but you know, to me, it's a question of fairness. And, you know, I ask for a lot of things at Christmas, too, but I don't get them. And I realize that, you know, I always ask big and get small. But, of course, it is small. You know. But anyway, you know, I'm just hoping if this goes forward in this proposal, and I hope the committee and the university seriously consider, because in no way am I criticizing the proposal. I'm just looking at the cost. But maybe when I'm 84 years old and the last $16.5 million proposal is $16.5 million is being paid as it ramps down to 15 and then 12 and 8 and 3 the next few years, that as I slap myself on the forehead, you'll have a cure for shaken brain syndrome. So with that, I guess I've said my piece. And
well, thank you for that, Representative Rukavina. And we have one more question yet, and then we have to take care of the proposed amendment. So, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, my question was all along the same lines as Representative Rukavina, and I won't take any time building a base like he did, but I'm wondering how you arrived at 20% and and how the university intends to meet that obligation. What are the sources of covering that? Fundraising, taking portions of grants you received to cover some of that. Can you tell us how you arrived at that and how you intend to achieve it?
Mr. Bissonnette.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, when this proposal, you know, we're on our third year here, which was originally conceived, we did a financial pro forma of a typical building. And in taking a look at that and running different scenarios about two-thirds, one-third, 90-10, we had 80-20. We ended up with our original proposal at 90-10. The Senate twice has passed this bill, and it was the Senate that decided to change it to 80-20. So I'm not advocating you change it to two-thirds, one-third. But that's how we arrived at the 80-20, was really moved by the Senate. Our original proposal was 90-10.
Thank you for that.
In terms of how to pay for it, I mean, clearly we're going to put a priority on fundraising to help cover that part of our responsibility. Absent that, we will be issuing the debt and financing that on the backs of my colleagues here.
Thank you for that. Representative Hausman.
And Madam Chair, if you're passing the amendment, then we'll just have President Brunig come forward for some conclusions. We do have it, Representative. We do have the amendment. She'll conclude after the amendment, if you okay.
Did you want to move the amendment, Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's my amendment, and I'll move it.
Representative Burns moves Amendment AN-A14. All those in favor, say aye.
No, comment?
Okay.
Yeah, I'll be happy to explain
okay.
it. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I'm going to make one comment before I do. I know this committee will fund priorities like deeper transportation and clean water. And after we do that, I look at all $4 billion worth of projects in front of us, and my number one priority would be passing this particular project. And not only have we heard, we have the ability to bring the smartest faculty in the world here to Minnesota. They will do great research. That research will be commercialized, and we'll have a high-performance job creation engine. And not only that, but we might cure cancer or diabetes or some other important illness. And we need to do it now. That said, I do have an amendment. The idea for this amendment came to me, as I said, on the Bioscience Committee, which is Representative Mahoney's committee, and we had some venture capitalists come in and talk to us about things the university could do to help them commercialize, and in essence, it's allowing them to work with the university on a fee-for-service process. And I know the university is doing good things. We've heard a presentation in the Bioscience Committee about the one-stop shop for business and to make it easy to commercialize research. I did not want to be heavy-handed because I don't think really, to a certain extent, we need to be too detailed in telling the university how to run their operation. So I did work with Vice President Mulcahy to get the wording right on this amendment, and I can explain it further, but I think this is a pretty common sense amendment. It helps venture capitalists and others use the university. It deals with a problem that we've seen or we've heard about from the venture capital community, and I hope it's one the committee can agree to.
And Madam Chair, I support the amendment. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair and members, this is the first I've actually seen the language, but Representative Burns has talked to me about this. I think this is a pretty good idea. I'm My only concern would be that it is focused on these four or five new buildings rather than the whole, by law, changing the policy of the university, because I don't want to do that.
Representative Carlson.
I'm interested in hearing from the university in terms of what the potential impact might be on some proprietary issues with the university and the research, and whether this language would create any problems in that regard.
And would you state your name for the record and let us know?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. I'm Tim Mulcahy. I'm Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota. And members, let me just point out that the university already, and to be honest with you, does this, what is incorporated here. The important point in this language is that we have the language consistent with its mission and governing policies, because there are Board of Regents policies that apply. For example, we do not want the university competing with private companies in the state of Minnesota to offer the same service. The services that we would provide in this capacity need to align with our mission of teaching, research, and outreach, and that's another limitation that's imposed by the Board of Regents. So this language basically says, and it would cover proprietary interests and things like that, if there were proprietary interests involved, in other words, if we provided intellectual input into this, this would be a problem. But this is something we do routinely already. I think there's been some experience of some of the members who've spoken to the various committees, or not members, but individuals who've spoken to the committee who had difficulties in this regard in their experience. I think this just makes explicit what the university has done all along anyway, and I think the language does indeed, because it includes our own statement with regard to mission and governing policies, cover things that we would need to be concerned about in that capacity.
Thank you. Next question is from Representative Fulbert.
I think it's okay. It's okay, because it does apply, as I understand, Minister, to the whole university, but it's consistent with your mission statement, so I think we're okay.
Any further questions? Representative
Sure, I was quite done. I guess that answered the proprietary question. We're also using the word shell here, and my history with working with the university was that you folks weren't particularly wild about the use of the word shell because of your constitutional autonomy, and I used to be told by a fellow by the name of Stan Kegler years ago that you even went to court at some point in your history over the word shell.
Mr. Mulcahy.
I'm trying to figure out exactly something clever I can say to address that response. The issue I would say is that, you know, I would have to defer to those with more experience with specific wording and what our legal history has been with individual words. I think the intent here is to say that we view this as something the university has done. It's an important function to continue, and I would have to defer to others with the specific language. Certainly predates my time here, so I couldn't address it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my time does go back a bit, but very seriously, anytime we would come forward with language, and if it included the word shell, the university would argue against it, and we'd usually find a compromise where you would come in with some language that avoided the use of shell. But my main question was the proprietary one, and I guess as this moves forward, maybe you want to consult with one of your historians about your constitutional autonomy and the use of the word shell.
Madam Chair, because this is obviously potentially included in the omnibus bill, what I would just pledge is to work with Representative Burns and the university on final language.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Hausman. Any further questions from members of the committee? If not, we'll go to a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Hausman, for
and I will refer to President Brunig with the closing remarks.
President Brunig.
Let me just, I know, I want to thank the committee for your patience. You've heard some, I think, excellent testimony as to why we think this is a very important bill. I also want to just very quickly note that Regent Dean Johnson has joined us, and I want to thank him for being here. I started by saying, why here and why now?
And I think you've heard from members of the industry, from university researchers, that we think one of the great strengths and comparative advantages of the University of Minnesota, and I would argue one of the great strengths and comparative advantages of our state, rest in this area of biomedical sciences and biosciences. It truly will be one of the growth areas in the world economy over the next several decades. I think it's interesting when I reflect for just a moment. I have seen very few proposals in my 40-year tenure at the University of Minnesota or proposals in the state of Minnesota that have garnered as much bipartisan support and as much support across the industry and business sectors of Minnesota. Minnesota Business Partnership does not typically endorse proposals that are outside of their own organization. They have endorsed this one. The Biobusiness Alliance, you heard from today, Dale was here to speak with you. Life Sciences Alley, the Minnesota High Tech Council, the Minnesota Medical Association, just to name a few of these organizations. And so this is a proposal that is supported by the major industries in Minnesota. They know that it's very directly tied to the human capital agenda they need to survive in Minnesota. It's also necessary to create the innovation, I think, that will fuel these companies and our economy in the future. So Representative Rukavina asked for advice, and I've never been reluctant to give him advice. I think I should lower your level of anxiety and urge you to support this proposal. We also have a treatment we've already discovered for shaky head syndrome.
Stop hitting yourself.
I can't help it. I'm going to be doing it. But I just want to say publicly, nice glasses. Are those designer glasses?
They go with my $500 suit. But anyway, I urge you to support this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And so then, Representative Hausman, you move this bill to be laid over and included in the for possible inclusion in the final capital investment bill. All then, at meeting is adjourned.